Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. As South Dakotans watch the jousting in Congress over tax reform, many are asking the age-old question, what's in it for me? People want to know what happens come tax time for them if the largest tax code overhaul in 30 years has the votes to signal a big win for congressional Republicans. How do South Dakotans fare in the new proposal? Joy Smolniski is with the South Dakota Budget and Policy Institute. She joins us now from Custer on the phone. Joy, welcome back to In the Moment.
Thank you for inviting me.
Everyone I talk to has the same question. How is it going to impact me during tax time? But there's a big picture.
Yeah, there certainly is a big picture, but we all, as you say, want to see both the big picture and our immediate picture.
All right. Do you want to start with the big picture or you want to start with the immediate picture?
Well, let's start with a clarification of how you figure out what your immediate picture is. Then we'll go to the big picture and come down.
Okay.
Your real tax changes is going to depend on how much money your household in your tax filing, how much money you have to pay taxes on, because your bracket amounts will change, what you have to pay as your marginal rate, meaning your top rate that you have to change. And also there'll be some big winners and losers among households that currently get benefits, who will lose them, and households that don't get benefits, who gain them. So as this juggling act in Washington goes on, we want to see where our favorite plums are falling if you are a taxpayer, so you find out how you will come out. And let me give you an example from South Dakota. In South Dakota, 75% of the students who graduate from our colleges here graduate with student debt. It's one of the highest rates in the nation. That debt averages about $31,000. Now, these students have to pay interest on that debt. And in the past, the interest was tax deductible. Under the new proposals, it wouldn't be tax deductible. So these are the kind of details you want to be looking for.
NPR had something on yesterday about graduate school, grad students as well, and their tax rate going up something like 300%.
And even more so, if you work for a business that says, you know, if you go back and get continuing education for your work, we'll pay for that as a benefit. In the past, that wasn't a taxable benefit. Under this new program, if they pay for you to take a master's course or a bachelor's course, you'll have to pay income taxes on the value of that education that your employer provides you.
Okay, what about other normally non-taxable benefits? Are there others?
Well, one of the benefits that is just the reverse in most states or in the federal code in the past are property taxes, our state income taxes, if we have them, we don't have them in South Dakota, and our sales tax were deductible. Now they're taking, they call that the salt taxes, state and local taxes, you know, really the salt of the earth stuff where we pay for local services. In the future, we will not have salt taxes covered under the one chamber's plan, and then they will be covered up to like $10,000 for property taxes on the other chamber's plan. In South Dakota, that doesn't hurt us as much because we don't have high income taxes in our states. Our neighbors like Nebraska or Minnesota, who have higher income taxes and won't be able to deduct those, are hurt more than we are by that particular tax change.
Who wins big in the state of South Dakota? Who really benefits from this?
There's no question that the richest 1% benefit most. Now, we would think, of course, the richest 1% would benefit most. They pay the most taxes. So when we analyze that data, instead of looking at it and saying, whoa, by 2027, the House plan has them each getting an average tax break of over $100,000, what we look at instead is what percentage of income is their tax break. And what was particularly surprising to me is that the richest 1% in South Dakota not only do very much better than the other 99%, but they also, because they get a tax break by 2027, they get 57% of the entire tax break is going to that comes to South Dakota, is going to that small percentage. But what's different is it's more than double what other states 1% get. We don't usually see that in South Dakota. But in South Dakota, apparently our richest 1% are going to have a significantly higher tax break in that 100,000 plus range, whereas for the rest of the nation, it's going to be more like 50,000 for that tax break.
Interesting.
For the top 1%.
Any thoughts on why that is in South Dakota? Help me put that in perspective.
I have not been able to crunch the data well enough to by individual taxpayer. That data is, this is aggregate data. So right. I can't tell you if it's because those individuals are beneficiaries of trusts and estates, or if they're the beneficiary of farming, or if they are people who live, who have their tax home in South Dakota, but don't actually have a lot to do with South Dakota, but their tax home is here because of the lack of state income tax. It's very hard to know on these extremely high incomes who they are and what their data, their money source is.
So the changes, as I understand it, and help clarify this for me, there's certain changes that happen right away, and then, as you said, there's a 10-year outlook. Does it pretty much increase in the same direction, whereas if, you know, you get a benefit now, you get more of a benefit in the future, or is it not really work that way?
Excellent question. Under the House proposal, the benefit for the top income earners in the 1% and the top 5% increases over time in South Dakota, and the benefit for the lower income earners, that's the other 95% of households, goes down over the 10-year time. And that's because some of the changes, like eliminating the estate tax, doesn't kick in till the end, and so that's a huge benefit for very rich families. Doesn't affect, in fact, that tax right now only hits 0.2% of the estates in the United States, so very few families hit that. But then other tax benefits, like a $300 exemption or deduction amount for non-children dependents, that is going to actually phase out after 5 years. It goes away. And newsflash for this morning, the Senate just announced that every single individual tax break will disappear on year 10, and they'll only leave in the business tax rates in outgoing years.
What does that mean?
That means that any breaks that are targeted for individual people or households, those are going to evaporate after 10 years. We'll have what we saw before with the Bush tax cuts, where they had a cliff, and they said, okay, these tax cuts are only in place for this long, and then they expire. And then the pressure's on Congress to put them back and make them permanent.
Okay,
what would remain would stay permanent. So you would lose your double the standard deduction. You would lose your increased child tax refund. You would lose all of that, but you would, and you'd go to higher brackets again. But business would keep its tax break from 35% to 20%. That's the plum that stays in regardless of what the tax situation is in the United States in 10 years.
And that is a... Go ahead.
What's interesting about that is that money is a savings for corporations. Statistical analysis shows that on the generous side, over a 10-year period, mostly during the end of the 10 years, about 25% of that savings will accrue to workers. And it'll because that's because businesses will invest in their businesses in the United States or invest in their workers, and that may raise jobs and salaries. It may not, but it might. And so they credit it with a 25% distribution outside of the stockholders. 75% of that tax savings goes to stockholders. Who owns the stock? Wealthy households. But interesting, 35% of U.S. stock that would benefit is held by foreign nationals or foreign countries. So 35%, roughly $31 billion would go to non-U.S. households or citizens, but would go to people who own stock in U.S. companies abroad.
Interesting. Let's talk a little bit about economic growth. And, you know, you kind of alluded to it. Let's dig deeper into that, because what, you know, our congressional delegation is telling us is, you know, this plan will spur economic growth, which means more people are going to open businesses in South Dakota. Your wages are going to go up. It's all part of a plan to sort of goose the economy. How do we think about that?
Well, obviously, in the data that I suggested to you, the rosiest case scenario for increasing the economy is that about 25% of that goes back into business investment of the tax savings. The other 75% gets distributed to shareholders as increased profits. So you don't have the entire tax savings going into business. Right now, businesses are sitting on some of the largest piles of cash that they've had in a long time and not spending it, not because, so the problem for large corporations isn't so much that they don't have cash to invest in their businesses, but they don't have a good investment, return on investment opportunity that will, presenting itself, or they're just choosing not to use the cash they have. So the tax refund comes to them without any requirement as a business that they reinvest it in the economy at all. They can choose to distribute it to their shareholders if they'd want to.
Let's talk about the least of these. How do the poor in South Dakota fare in this? Is there anything in the tax reform plan that benefits or does not benefit, hurts the working poor?
The thing I would be most concerned about is the new proposals just today that they take off the Obamacare mandate for health care coverage, and by doing so, believe they would have a tax savings of $338 million. Now, that was a number that was put together by the Congressional Budget Office. Since that release, they have said, you know, I don't think this number is right. It's too high because we thought all 16 million of those people would end up being folks who are in regular private insurance, but the truth is many of them would be people who don't sign up for Medicaid. Mm-hmm. And so the savings for each one of those people is smaller, and part of the savings goes to the state. So the federal government would have a smaller net savings by taking away insurance requirements for 16 million. On the other hand, the impact of that, and this is really the least of these, folks who can't afford health insurance, who would choose not to buy health insurance, are generally in the lower income brackets, or else they are struggling to make ends meet, and they're having to choose between rent and utilities and food and health insurance. Mm-hmm. If you take away the incentive to do that, we have seen a 50% decline in medical bankruptcies since we've had required mandated insurance. So it's like we have required mandated insurance on the car you drive. So if you do damage, it has to be some way that people can recoup the damage you've done. If you don't have health care and you show up at the emergency room, somebody's got to pay the bill for your care when you come in the ambulance after a car wreck. If you don't have insurance, that cost gets shifted to the rest of us who are carrying insurance. So there will be a savings from knocking those people out of the healthcare system, but there'll be a cost that won't really be seen that will be distributed to everyone who buys a healthcare policy, either through their work or through the exchange or whatever other means they have access to healthcare.
One of the other selling points of this is we've had several conversations on this program about the tax reform proposals is this notion of simplification, simplifying the tax code until most people could file their returns on something the size of a postcard. And I'm interpreting that, let me just ask you, what do you make of that promise and is it worth it?
Well, if I right now can deduct my charitable tithe to my church, if I can deduct my taxes on my house, if I can deduct any of my medical expenses over 10%, and that amount gets me over the $12,000 or so for a deduction, I get additional benefit from that. Under this change, I won't get any additional benefit for that charitable work or for the taxes that I pay or for the medical out-of-pocket expenses I incur. And I also will lose all my exemptions, which are about equal to the doubling of the deduction. So, yes, it may be simpler not to do an itemized return, but it won't allow people who have extraordinary circumstances that have been tax deductible in the past to itemize unless they are very high income households and their itemizations go over that new $24,000 limit. So you'll lose the ability of smaller income households, and I'm talking about anybody 100,000 and below, to really be able to offset any of their tax burden with the type of things I've talked about: student loans, mortgage interest, property taxes, and charitable contributions.
This mentality, when people, there's two questions I really want to ask here, and the first one is this: the mentality of how does this impact me? It is important and understandable. How should we think about tax reform in the big picture for the state as well as our own households?
Well, I believe that as a political entity that is responsible for paying its debts, no tax reform should be increase our deficit. This tax reform increases our deficit for $1.5 trillion over the first 10 years. So that is a concern for our children, our grandchildren, even ourselves 10 years down the line, when we, instead of having a national debt of 77% of GDP, our national debt, even without this tax reform, if we just left tax like it is, would be over 100% of GDP in 20 years. Now, with this tax cut, it will be far more than that. So we will see an increase in our national debt because of non-revenue neutral tax reform. That I think we should be concerned about. And then the second piece of that, anytime we are collecting money for taxes, there has to be a sense of, is this a fair distribution of the costs? And are the benefits that we are paying for with this really good for our country as a whole? If you've got a moment, I'll tell you one personal example or example of what I mean by that.
Absolutely.
So you've got a family. We got a family right now with an estate of $24 million, and they've got a kid that's graduating from high school, going to go to college, and they basically get killed in a car crash, unfortunately, and he inherits the $24 million. Right now, he can inherit $11 million from his parents with no taxes at all, but he would have to pay federal estate taxes on the extra dollars. The money that he will not have to pay in taxes on that extra $13 million is enough to fund over 1,000 of his classmates with a Pell Grant to go to college. So that's what you're choosing between. You're choosing between significantly lower estate taxes that are already at a high level, and will we have money available to encourage the kind of development of our population, both economically, educationally, and health-wise, to be able to be a vibrant economy.
Maybe you haven't looked into this yet either, and maybe it needs more data crunching as well, but when we talk about charitable giving no longer being deductible, do we have a sense of what the impact that could be on philanthropic organizations in the state?
Well, I'm certain that there is a high level of concern. Now, for a very high-income household, if a household with $1 million income determines they're going to tithe to their church, they're giving $100,000. So $75,000 of that would actually be tax deductible for them. If a family with $100,000 income decides to tithe to their church, they're giving $10,000. $10,000 just falls into that hole of what falls under your standard deduction, and you put that together with your property taxes and your interest on your mortgage, and you'll find you probably don't make it over the minimum, and so you don't end up itemizing deductions. You get no tax benefit for having made the charitable contribution. So for any households that are everybody in the bottom 80% basically of households is not going to be able to, as able to make a tax deductible contribution that will make a difference for them. That's why it's a simpler postcard kind of response, but that leaves them without that ability.
Are there small changes that could be made to the tax reform plan as it stands now that you think would make it more successful or would even things out a bit?
One of the things that I look at is the child care, the child credit. Families incur expenses raising children. And in those expenses in the past, we've had a child tax credit that was refundable that really targeted moderate and low-income families, families below $110,000. Now they're raising that eligibility rate to like $500,000 in one place and $1 million in the other. I can't remember which is the House and which is the Senate. So that means that families that really aren't struggling to pay the bills to raise children are getting the same tax credit as families that are making $24,000 or a single parent working at minimum wage making $15,000. So we have to ask ourselves the question, is this on a macroeconomic level a good way to invest in the children that parents are raising in our country to further subsidize parenting for well-off families or to focus our subsidy of parenting only for families who have moderate to low incomes that struggle meeting those children's needs?
Any final thoughts, Joy, before we let you go? It's been fascinating. Any things that we didn't cover that we really should have?
The importance, I think I'm glad you brought up the importance of being fiscally responsible, not just following our economic self-interest and saying, what's in this tax reform for me, but saying, what's best for our country? What's a fair distribution of the responsibility to pay taxes and the benefits that come from those taxes? And are the changes we're making more equitable and more fair and more in line with what we believe is in our country's long-term best interest?
Joy Smolniski is with the South Dakota Budget and Policy Institute. She joined us from Custer on the phone. Joy, thank you so much. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for the invitation.